The Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, and welcome to episode 31 of The Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson. We've got a good one for you today. The great film historian Richard M. Roberts. I've been wanting to get Richard on the show for quite a while, so this is quite a treat. And we had a good time talking about Slapstick, Silent Films, his upcoming book, Slapstickon, and many and diverse subjects. I'm going to do something that I've never done before, which is offer a correction right off the bat. That is, we're talking about Slapstickon, and Richard mentions that they're going to be showing a rarely seen film based on the comic strip Bringing Up Father with Maggie and Jiggs. And with just a slip of his tongue or brain, he mentions that the artist is George Harriman. And I immediately chime in with something like, yes, that's right, George Harriman it is. And of course it isn't George Harriman. George Harriman was the creator of the brilliant and enduringly wonderful Crazy Cat. But the cartoonist behind Bringing Up Father was George McManus. So when you hear that part, just remember that we are talking about so many things that it is quite natural to get a name wrong here or there. And besides, the George is right. You got to admit that. So Richard Roberts is one of the great experts on silent comedy, and his book is going to be really something. He brought a digital copy of it for me to just scan through a little bit. And even though I couldn't spend more than 10 minutes scrolling down the files, I saw a lot of stills that make me want to see this book and read this book and own this book, and so I shall. And I think that a lot of you will want to have it too, because it's something special. So anyway, he'll tell you more about that stuff in the upcoming conversation. So enjoy this talk with Richard M. Roberts, and we'll see you on the other side. You and I are kindred spirits in one way.
Okay.
And that is that we tend to gravitate toward the things that are not necessarily in the public view. That we, instead of writing about Chaplin, Keaton,
yeah,
and Lloyd,
oh, yeah, well,
you're writing about Toto.
Well, who wants to write about stuff that other people have already written about? What's the point?
Yeah.
You know.
That's my point of view. Then that's why I don't sell books.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my book is, as I've told you, it's called The World's Longest Footnote, because it's a book about Hal Roach that doesn't talk about Laurel and Hardy, Harold Lloyd, our gang, Thelma Todd and Zazu Pitts, or the boyfriends.
See, that makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah. But we're depending on those Eddie Boland and Taxi Boy fans.
Yeah.
You know.
There are plenty of them.
And I know there's got to be at least one person out there obsessed with Toto who's going to buy the book just to see more Toto stills than you'll ever see in one place. One other shared thing we both have is basically outside income from this interest. So it's like, what is the point in doing anything that's not fun or interesting to us?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know I'm never, as I've told every publisher I'd offered this book to, I'm never going to make enough money for you not to do this the way I want it. That's the fun. I wanted to learn about these people because, you know, plenty of other people had told me about Buster Keaton. And although sure, there's still the great Buster Keaton biography, you know, waiting to be written. So maybe one day I will have to write it. But we'll see. You know, I've got and the book, which, shall we give them the title now?
Yeah, I wish you would.
Let's plug the thing. Smileage Guaranteed, Past Humor, Present Laughter, The Comedy Musings on the Comedy Film Industry, 1910 to 1945, Volume 1, Hal Roach. That's it. Okay, I got
that
it.
That is quite a title.
Yeah, get that on a marquee. You know, that's actually why Smileage Guaranteed was at the top, because we need something that they will,
sure,
you know, remember, because you know, when the writer can't remember the whole title of the book, you know you're in trouble. But it is. It's this magnum, the musings on the comedy film industry, all that middle part, is the magnum three-volume opus that this thing, If I Live Long Enough, is going to be, based on a bunch of articles I wrote for Classic Images in the 90s called Past Humor, Present Laughter, which nobody remembers now, so we could probably cut that part of it anyway. The first volume is the Hal Roach stuff. The second volume is all the is basically the history of and all the production companies, comedians that revolved around a company called Educational Pictures, the worst named comedy film company of all
Agreed.
Time.
Agreed, yeah.
And the third volume is everything I couldn't fit in the first two volumes. So
that's what volume threes are always good for.
Yes, yes, yes.
Now, take me back a little bit on how you got started, because I realize I've asked this question in much the same way to several people,
yeah.
Which is, none of us was alive when silent movies were out, so we don't, it's not nostalgia for us, it's not, so it, we all came to it in some weird way. What was your way?
But you notice, and I will say this, having listened to your podcast and know a number of the people, you notice the way is pretty much similar.
Often is.
Television.
Yeah.
Because, especially in the area of silent film comedy, which frankly was looked down upon by most of the major archives for years. Iris Berry was tossing 35mm nitrate prints of comedies in the MoMA trash bins, where a guy named Milt Manel was filching them out, and it became the Manel Collection, which is now at LOC. No one was paying attention to stuff. One of the major preservers of a large chunk of silent comedy was television. Because even, you know, from the minute television started, you had, you know, no matter how many channels you had all this time to fill. And, hey, there's all these old two-reel silent comedies from companies that have been out of business for years and nobody owns them. Let's put them up on the tube. Even the Weiss Brothers are famous group we'll probably talk about later when I plug Weissarama, the DVD, they were selling prints of their silent comedies television as early as 1947.
Wow.
So this stuff was on television, especially kid shows. You had good old Howdy Doody, which basically was supplied by Milton Manel, the Milton Manel Collection. Hey, you've got, you know, 10 minutes of silent comedy a day. Buffalo Bob doesn't have to write that 10 minutes of the show. We just stick it up and make comments behind it. So that's why you have a lot of guys my age, basically, especially on the East Coast, who really got into silent comedy just basically due to Howdy Doody. You had, you know, Our Gang was on there. You know, the Silents were on the cut-up compilation packages like the Mischief Makers. Company did Mischief Makers, did Comedy Capers. Then, of course, we had good old Robert Youngson.
Sure.
You know, we were all seeing those at the kiddy matinees because that's where all those things played. I was a child of television just like anybody else who, you know, grew up in the 60s, you know, 50s and 60s. And that's where I saw it. We had, you know, coming. I'm from Phoenix, born and raised in Phoenix. I can say that because my family's been there so long. We said, you know, we met the Goldwaters at the train. So we were there before all the crazy gun-toting, Bible-thumping loonies moved there. We had a great show. The longest-running kid show, actually, in the history of television. They did a thing on the Pioneers of Broadcasting on PBS about him. Wallace and Ladmo was on for 36 yeah. years. Bill Thompson, the guy who played Wallace, who was basically the creator and the driving force behind the show, huge old movie, silent comedy fan. So they were running this stuff. They were running all the great Warner Brothers cartoons. They made their own comedy silent movies. So I've been doing this since before I can remember. My parents bought me my first 8mm Thunderbird projector from Sears.
Yeah, just don't keep talking while you do it because it's going.
Best thing on the shows that I've loved so far was you and Carl Davis avoiding the Mary Kay lady. Yeah, old
couldn't get away.
Old Sandovic guy. I would have paid good for 15 minutes of that track because you could use that in like Seven Chances when all the brides are chain buster.
If we had recorded in my room, you wouldn't believe what you
heard.
Oh, it was
just what you got. It was, oh, yeah. That's a sound you're not going to be able to ever Foley or recreate, you know. But anyway.
It was harrowing.
Oh, it's great. What the hell are we talking about?
You're talking about TV.
TV. Like I said, I got beyond that. My folks bought me my first projector when I was 5 years old. I was apparently collecting 78s before that.
Wow.
When I was four, because, again, born in Phoenix, but farm background, had a farm up in Lantry, South Dakota. I was apparently listening to the old 78s up on the farm. And I do remember being told by an aunt, you know, and this is another thing that I've talked with other people about who are in our field of interest, and it all seems at some point to have clicked with them. You're playing, you know, you're listening to something, and my aunt tells me, well, so-and-so that you're listening to has been dead for years. And you're like, wow. you're time traveling.
Yeah.
I'd always tell people, you know, I said, the only real, you know, that movie screen is our one real time travel. That's Window on the Past.
Yeah.
And
that was definitely the thing for me. Absolutely,
yeah.
It was.
Yeah. And that, even at the age of four, was apparently fascinating to me. Yeah. And, of course, I brought those home, which is why I have a nice original Jimmy Rogers Memorial picture disc that my grandma bought from Montgomery Wards when it was new, and stuff like that. But so when people ask me how I get into this, I really have to honestly say, I don't know, because I've been doing it as long as I can remember.
Yeah, the interesting thing to me is that your story is very similar to my story.
Yeah.
Just gravitated to this stuff for whatever reason. But what I can never quite grasp is why me, why you? Because I remember when Stan Laurel died.
Right.
Our class, we had to do current events every day. We had to clip something out of the paper and bring it in and read it. And that day, every single person in the class brought in Stan Laurel is dead.
Yeah.
Every single person in my class.
Sure.
It was a big deal to everybody.
Sure.
So everybody loved Laurel and Hardy when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But I stuck with it and they didn't. And that's what I wonder about. Why do I still love Laurel and Hardy, and why did I pursue that, and they didn't?
But it really was one whole generation, and we all got into it in the same way, because it was basically, saw them on television, kind of shit, and usually at some point, you found the advertisement in Boy's Life or at a camera magazine, Black Hawk Films,
mm-hmm.
that magic name for all of that generation. Because, again, as we were talking about earlier, it is. It's one generation, which is why, you know, I say I started out in this as one of the youngest people in it, and 45 years later, I still am, which is not a good thing. Because
it's true, though.
The ranks are thinning, and they're not being, you know, replenished.
When I went to my first CineCon, everybody there was in their 20s, as I was, and now everybody is my age, and there's nobody in their 20s.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
And it's, and it is. The other lucky thing I think our generation had, because this is another thing I've started to talk with people about. The real irony is, you now we're getting to the age where we can be genuinely nostalgic. Because as you said, Laurel and Hardy is not nostalgia for us. You know, it maybe peripherally it is, but we didn't see them when they were new, you know, active. But what is nostalgic for me now is putting on an episode of the Hollywood Palace and seeing the great thing about the 60s was you still basically had a number of that great generation of entertainers who were still doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, I first saw Buster Keaton in the Beach Blanket Bingo Pictures. I mean, I thought of him as an old person who was suddenly, hey, he's also this younger guy who does these great silent movies. And there was still a respect for the past, which, of course, does not exist in our society now.
Yeah.
Because we're completely anti the past, because all the folks that own and run things don't want you to remember all these tricks they did to your grandparents so they can do them again to you now. So you don't But back then, you would get these odd, thanks to shows like Hollywood Palace and Ed Sullivan, all these variety shows, you know, you'd have Ed Wynn introducing the Rolling Stones.
Sure.
You know, and even the Beatles. You know, Paul McCartney was a huge fan of 30s, you know, 20s, 30s music, and the Beatles, you know, channeled some of that into their own music.
And the Beatles were a huge doorway for me to that stuff.
Same here.
Yeah, because I listened to them religiously and sought out what their influences were.
That's right.
So, yeah.
And Randy Scredved, same way.
Oh, sure.
A huge Beatles fan. And again, that's all. Again, yeah, I, you know, the Beatles and you know, the 60s rock and roll. And then suddenly, you know, yeah, that was the... You know, the door that opened you to, you know, Louis Armstrong, who was still alive then, and again, was still performing. Duke Ellington, you know, all the great jazz. There was still good country and western. You know, there was still good. Started to give up on modern culture in the late 70s, completely tuned it out by the 90s, which is why I couldn't even tell you what was Oscar nominated this year, much less what it was about. And, but there was still some interesting modern culture, and there was still a lot of respect for the old culture, the old performers. And so these were all the things our little pre-teenage brains were sucking up and taking in. But it was prevalent enough in mainstream culture that there was a sizable generation of people who got interested in it.
I remember that Bonnie and Clyde was such an enormous hit that it actually spawned this vogue about the 1930s.
Well, sure.
And so local TV channels would start showing movies from the 30s, like, hey, this is the Bonnie and Clyde era. And so we actually had access to a lot of that stuff because of that, that we wouldn't have had otherwise.
Well, that was the other thing. As much as I will decry, you know, Phoenix as the land of yahoos and a cultural wasteland now, it was a hell of a great place to grow up for a film buff. Because the other places, I mean, for starters, we had Channel 5, which was the number one independent station in the country, was the Wallace and Ladmo station. But between it and the other stations, they were still running every major studio 50s film package. Channel 5 was running the CNC television package into the like late 80s. You know, Channel 12 had the EMCA pack, had a great old EMCA package. So, you know, and again, I was a night owl my whole life because I loved The Tonight Show. And then I discovered, oh, hey, they're running W.C. Field movies on The Big Show at midnight on Channel 12. So we're watching, you know, so I had that. We had... the other great influence, the pizza parlor chains, you know, within my circle of radius from my folks' house, I had a Straw Hat Pizza, a Shakey's, and a Village Inn Pizza, all of which ran movies.
Wow.
All were a bike ride, you know, one and a half mile bike ride away from my house. And I had a circuit. I mean, I remember, I knew, you know, like Straw Hat always changed their films on Wednesdays and Shakey's. and they were
all silent movies?
Everything you could imagine. Straw Hat actually was renting everything from Modern Sound Pictures. So you would, you know, I remember going to Shakey's and seeing, you know, Columbia comedies, Hal Roach comedies. The first time I saw like Roscoe Arbuckle and Buzzin' Around, you know, they had Warner Brothers Vitaphone shorts.
Wow.
Shakey's was running honest to God features. You know, all 16 millimeter or you know, later they were those weird little Super 8 cartridge things, but this all 16 millimeter. In fact, years later, when Shakey's went out of business in Phoenix, I bought like 35 Bell and Howell auto load machine. I've never cleaned more pizza grease out of a projector. But, so, like I said, I mean, we had, you know, I was collecting films. We had in the 70s, probably between 30 and 50 film collectors in the Valley.
Wow.
All of them I knew. I started a film society in 1970 when I was still, you know, a kid, couldn't even drive yet, with Buster Crabb, actually, the Classical Film Society, which ran for 20 years. We had the Mesa Public Library, which was running all the MoMA 16mm stuff. We had two art houses, which ran into the 1980s. And like I said, and on PBS, Channel 8, the public television station, from starting 1971 and running, I think, till about 1990, they ran a show called Cinema Classics, which ran two films every week, no commercials. And they were booking stuff from every, they were running Films Inc. stuff. I'm never sure how Nick Salerno got away with that, but you know. So we were seeing things. That's what I remember, because they were still doing that when, just at the beginning of Betamax and VHS and that kind of stuff. And so I suddenly had trading material like Just Imagine and the 19, you know. Oh, we shouldn't be talking about this one. Never mind. No, we didn't do any of that. But I mean, so we were seeing amazing stuff. You know, I mean, I was coming over to LA all the time. And I'd be telling people, you know, oh, we just ran The Big Trail on Channel 8, you know, with John Wayne. Yeah, they showed it like 3 weeks. Wow. You know, so it was a great place to see stuff.
Wow.
And,
that's better. That same time, I'd just gone to Boston, got to Boston in 71, because in South Carolina, I couldn't see anything.
Right.
They didn't show anything. But Boston was a wonderland, but on TV it wasn't all that great. But in terms, because Boston was loaded to the gills with colleges, and every one of those colleges had a film society, and then there were revival theaters everywhere. That was where it really exploded for me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Arizona State University had Neeb Hall, which ran the AFI Rediscovering American Film Program, and all the RBC Chaplin stuff when it came out. And
that's about the time the silent years started PBS.
Yep.
And
Paul Killian.
Stuff. Man, that stuff was really important.
But see, it's all the same stuff. Though, getting back to the original question, which you asked 20 minutes ago.
That's the way this works.
Right? I know. But that's, you know, there was a whole group of us who all tuned into that, and you know, I always, if I want to make myself feel more normal, and I start to worry, you know, and I look around all these stacks of film and all this other stuff in the house, you know, I just go, this house could be filled with baseball cards, you know, or guns,
sure. A lot of things that people collect.
Yeah.
Hummel figurines you could have.
And looking back on it in hindsight, as weird, nerdy, as strange as it was, what it has enabled me to do in my... I mean, I've traveled around the world. I've met people I would never have imagined meeting. And even more amazingly, I stole my better half, Linda, away from the Library of Congress to archive the Roberts collection and look after Mr. Roberts. If I wasn't interested in this, you know, God knows what I would have done. You know?
Sure.
It's been an interesting... Was Edward Dimitri said, you know, it's a lousy living but an interesting life, or a lousy life but a wonderful life. I don't know, whatever. I have no
Either
complaints.
Way, yes. Well, did you just normally start to skew beyond the mainstream in your film interest? Or did you first see all the classic stuff, get up to speed on all of that, and then just started looking in the nooks and crannies?
Well, I watched what I saw, what was there to watch. It's another kind of, you know, I've been sort of typecast. You know, I love it. In film history, it's just like Hollywood. We get typecast.
Sure we do, yeah.
You're the Alamo guy, you know. I'm the comedy guy. But, you know, comedy doesn't even make up 50% of my collection. I mean, I have a very large, sizable film collection, mostly because I worked for a lot of those TV stations with those nice packages about the times that they were throwing the stuff out the back doors. And I kept all my film. I bought collections from all these guys. Went, hey, I'd rather have a videotape. You know, make me a videotape transfer and I'll sell you my collection. Sure. No problem. And again, I grew, being the youngest guy in the thing, I was hanging around a lot of older film collectors. I always had a fellow by the name of Gary Locker, who's an old collector, who I'd say was basically my mentor. But we had a number of others. You know, Jack Hardy moved out to Phoenix in the 70s, who runs Grapevine Video, an old-time cinephile. And so it would be, you know, I've never been as narrowly focused in my interest as a lot. You know, I mean, there are people out there who, you know, can't watch a film made after June 1st, 1934 or before, you know, so on. I mean, there's some very narrowly focused people out there.
Yeah, I don't get those, no.
And I watch anything once. You know,
I like good movies. That's right. My only criterion.
Not even necessarily because as we were talking about lunch earlier here, you get to a point where it doesn't matter whether it's a good or bad movie. Mm. You know, it's all old friends, and even if it's a bad movie, you're going. You know, I was like, you know, we'll throw on, you know, any old B picture now, and you're going, oh, hey, there's Bob Cortman, there's Leo Willis, there's, you know, so. You're just glad, you know, you're just seeing, you know, see, but what amazes me, you know, 45 plus years of doing this, that there's still all this stuff I haven't seen.
Yeah. It amazes me in a way, because there's a huge number of things. Every year, I was looking at your Slapstickon program that you brought me from 2010.
Yeah.
And there's tons of stuff in there that I saw that I've never even heard of.
Sure.
And I didn't just fall off the film banana boat. But there's this enormous field of stuff.
An awful lot of people spent their whole lifetimes making this stuff. So we're going to spend our lifetimes looking at it. And the problem is now we're getting to the point that we're getting so old and geezery, we've forgotten the ones we've seen, so we got to see them again.
Yeah, that's always the tough part.
Yeah, well, it's really true. You know, we were talking about, you know, showing War Horses. It's like, you know, we'll sit down some nights now and we're like, well, let's, you know, what do you want to see? Yeah. So a few weeks ago, you know, Linda said, let's watch The Seahawk. Errol Flynn, I said, eh, I've seen it. And I thought, yeah, I saw it 35 years ago. Yeah. When was the last time I watched it? Put it on. It's like seeing a new movie. Yeah. So we get to you know, that's actually fun. Now, you know, we still have new stuff. We can revisit the old stuff. It's just, who needs cable?
Yeah. Yeah, somebody recently we were talking about Murnau, and they'd asked me if I'd seen City Girl, and I said, sure. I did. I saw it at CineCon in 1979.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it since.
Yeah.
So I really haven't seen it. I don't remember a thing about it. So I lied when I said I'd seen it.
And it's amazing because, like I said, there have been a number of films you come back and revisit now. And it is amazing how your memory plays tricks on, you know, on what's there. And,
so. And sometimes they're better than you thought they were, and sometimes they're not as good. I recently watched for the first time since I wrote the book on Wellman, Young Eagles, which I did not remember thinking was any good at all, and was surprised to find out how good I thought it was, and how much really interesting stuff is in that movie. And so, you know, if I just went off my memories from when I was writing that book in 1982, I would say, nah, not a good film. Now I say, yeah, see it. Yeah. It's a good movie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, when I'm writing stuff, absolutely. So when I was working on this book, and this book, like I said, is based on articles that I had written in the 90s, but of course I was revising everything, you know, in the book form. And so I realized very quickly I had to go back and rewatch everything. And actually, as I hate taking notes.
Sure.
I'm not one of these academics who, you know, the first time I want to see a film is I want to see, the point of watching a film is to watch the film.
I agree.
And I want to enjoy it. I want to have that experience. But then, you know, for writing, going back, you know, I'd have to sit there and go, okay, yeah, I definitely got to talk about this. Definitely got to talk about this. And yeah, again, just realizing, wow, that gag wasn't in that picture. It was in that picture. memory is never to be relied upon, you know, however good you think it is. And
what I'm always interested in is how little tiny gestures or gags will stick with you forever. Just little double takes that an Our Gang character would do that I saw when I was 6 years old. When I see it again, it's like a jolt of recognition. Oh, wow, that's that. Just these little tiny things would really dig in deep.
Well,
Max Davidson in that Our Gang short where, I know but I won't tell you.
Yeah, I won't tell you. Moan and groan and think.
I remember that my entire life. Sure. Just that.
We've all had little catchphrases, you know, in our groups. And, you know, it's like you have a hard time, you know, when you watch Harry Langdon to stop, not greet people like this. Or, you know, and then do the little wave, the Harry Langdon wave. I mean, but all of Ford and the Hawks all said, you know, movie making is just lots of great little moments. You know, if you have those, you're set. And that's, you know, comedy is all gags are just nothing but great little moments if they're good. But it's funny. It is, that's the stuff, you know, it is the little things you remember, you know. I mean, you know, house can fall on somebody. And yeah, it's impressive. But people are always, that's why I can't watch modern day movies. People are always way more interesting than machines. And in comedy, all the great gags to me involve character, you know, the human condition. You know, the mechanical gags can be good, but, you know, all the really great, you know, I mean, all great literature is something having to do with the human condition.
Yeah.
Because, let's face it, it's all we got, folks. And it just doesn't, you know, CGI does not impress me. You know, some computer geek sitting at his computer, you know, making things blow. You know, you look at the silent films, these guys went out, you know, built a building, ran a car off a cliff, got a real steamboat. That's one of the things always, when I introduce a comedy show to someone, I said, these people risked their lives for your entertainment, and you damn well better appreciate it. And that's true. Now, you know, all comedy, you know, comedy's just lame now, you know. It's a guy standing up and telling three or four, you know, jokes. They can't even tell a story or a monologue anymore.
Well, that is definitely something, and anybody who's heard this podcast before has heard me moan on about this, but it's definitely the space, the place, the locations, all these things are wonderful to see to me. And the more time passes, obviously I was not born in 1921, wouldn't be for a long time, I'm glad to say. But getting to see a downtown Hollywood in 1921 for a Buster Keaton gag is a magical experience. And and no amount of, you know, I'm not against CGI or anything like that. It does what it does, but it can never do that.
Yeah.
And it can never just precisely get this specific little place and time that films before, you know, 1940 are full of.
Well, and again, that's somebody that you realize the first half of the 20th century was the most amazing 50 years probably there will ever be. The 20s, I literally call the American Renaissance. And you realize this when you talk to anybody in any field of interest, any sort of collector, if they collect guitars, if they collect toy trains, if they anything. The amazing thing about the teens, 20s, maybe really into the 30s was this was the era where mass production still met artistic quality and value. They were learning how to mass produce things, but everything had a high creative bent to it, which is why, you know, you'll see restaurants with advertising signs from the 20s as their decorations, because they're more artistic than, you know, anything you're going to see now. And it just, in almost every level of anything from that era, you know, the reason that the movies were so good then, even though they were making way more of them, is just even at the mediocre programmer level, the level of creativity was beyond anything you see now. The quality of the writing, the quality of the acting, you know, all the stuff that matters, and the fact that they were willing to go out and blow up buildings and risk their lives. You know, it may not have been the most fun time to live. And this is why the unions came in the 30s. But
you had an impacted molar.
But, it's funny. One of the standard things was to every time I see a comedian running or, you know, swimming around in Echo Lake Park, you know, in Echo Lake in the 20s, I'm going, Christ, there's no antibiotics. These people are tough. You know? So, but yeah, it's, I mean, it was just an incredible era. And, you know, even when you're raised in the 60s, you could tell the difference between that level of quality and even what you had then. And of course, it's just gotten worse ever since. Which is why, you know, now movies are frankly just too stupid for me to watch. I mean, I can't, and they have characters that I wouldn't let in my house, you know, and it's just like, you know, it just makes no sense. They make no sense to me. And
I think what's the trick that is played on the civilization at large is that the level of technology has gotten to a point where everything looks fine. And so everything seems to be well made, and you have to actually pay attention to it to realize that it's not necessary.
Well,
but when I look at a film from the 20s, or look at films in general, some work better than others, but I have never seen one that wasn't made well, produced well. Yeah. I've never seen a single film from the 20s that wasn't produced well.
Even when you're looking at, you know, Anthony Zitti's Sunset Productions. Sure. They're well photographed. Yeah, so have I. Yeah. You know, the acting's, and it's just, because, you know, the constant thing I get being the comedy guys, why don't we have these kind of comedians today? I said, because you don't have the training ground.
Sure.
I said, all of these people came from, you know, vaudeville, musical, the circus. You know, these were, you know, these people were out there learning comedy, you know, 7 days a week, you know, 10, 12 hours a day in front of not very friendly audiences if you weren't good.
Yeah.
And if they could survive that, Hollywood was a tumble, you know.
Yeah.
And
well, vaudeville, what an incredible training ground. That multiple shows every day.
Right.
Basically doing your same act.
It was rough.
Yeah.
It was rough. And,
but by the time you got that act down, it was down. You really had something in your bones.
Well, right? and you understood how to deal with an audience.
Yeah.
Which is the other problem we have now with looking at these films is most of us are sitting in our living rooms on the couch watching these things by ourselves with the freeze frame and the fast forward.
Big mistake.
Not meant to be shown that way.
No.
You know, again, one of the first things I say when I present a comedy program or do SlapstickCon, I look at the audience and I go, you are an endangered species. You are what these things were meant for. You know, and you know, do your part. You know, you're an audience member. That's a responsibility. And I'll tell you, because it's, you know, we certainly don't make any money doing things like SlapstickCon, that's the reward, is seeing these things with an audience.
Yeah.
Because frankly, that's why I argue with, you know, especially a lot of these, you know, no-lifers who spend a lot of time in the internet and these, they go, oh, I watched Buster Keaton and Seven Chances and it wasn't funny. Well, you were what? Sitting there by, you know, for starters, you're a depressive on how many medications, sitting in a room by yourself, you know, watching this. It's like, okay. You know, don't expect me to, you know, you have a right to your opinion, I guess.
You know? I always think back to the first time The Exorcist showed on network television, and a friend at work the next day said, I watched it, it wasn't that scary. I said, yeah, it wasn't that scary with commercials, and you're sitting in your living room with the lights on, and the phone's ringing, and your dog's licking you, and you, of course it's not scary. You've got to be at its mercy in a way for something to work. And that is really true with movies.
Oh, sure.
You know what I just recently saw was a film that I'd always thought was a dog, which is Chaplin's Limelight. I'd seen it a couple of times. I actually saw it in the theater, but with nobody in it, and just thought it lay there like nothing. And we saw it at the Academy with 2,000 people. And when he came out to do his bits, getting laughs where they needed to be laughs, the whole thing came alive, and it worked like a charm. And now my opinion on that film has totally reversed from everything I ever thought it was, because I'd never seen it the way it should be seen. And I'm finding it harder and harder to convince people of that.
I know.
They think that I'm crazy or stupid, which you're not going to get a great deal of argument about that, but I'm right on this case. I'm right. And you've got to see these things. It's like watching, you know, I'm the Alamo guy, so watching John Wayne's The Alamo on TV. No, it's a 70-millimeter film. You got to see it huge, and you got to see it with surround sound. Oh, well, and
especially those 60s widescreen stereophonic. Oh, yeah. I was flying on an airplane. I look across at a guy who is watching It's a Mad, 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 Mad World on his iPad.
Ooh, man.
We're talking a narrow, thin, 2-inch line, and I just went... You know, it was just like my eyes rolled up in my head, and I'm just like, any chance that film has,
no.
It's got to be on a CinemaScope portion screen and everything. Yeah, it's just, I don't know. And again, that's the one of my geezerly no hope for the future attitudes is that, you know, when I'm seeing people watching films on a, yeah, I find it so ironic that, you know, when television started, they were watching these big, huge consoles with like 3-inch picture tubes.
Yeah.
And here, you know, and then we go on to these huge monstrous things. Now we're back to the 3-inch picture tubes again. You know.
Well, but this is, here's my glimmer of hope for the future. I may be wrong, but here it is. When the beginnings of our interest that you just described, we saw these things in many cases in very compromised forms, because we saw them on TV. Mm-hmm. A lot of times we saw silent movies with very with lousy music or at the wrong speed, and
don't get us started on speed.
We saw all these, we were buying 8-millimeter dupe copies of things. Mm-hmm. So in many ways our enthusiasm was born out of substandard viewing experiences, and we move toward the light, and somewhere in the most optimistic part of my heart says maybe somebody watching something on his iPad will someday realize, wait a minute, I need to see this on it. You know, maybe it'll grow. I don't know.
I tell you, but I think we're seeing them just as compromised now as then. It's just a different compromise. Well, we'll keep this film speed thing down to a minimum, but because again, if you have any actual historical knowledge, most silent films, especially from the 20s on, were run at speeds of, faster than shot.
Of course, yeah.
And you know, we're fighting this whole thing of the concept of natural speed, and I'm going, there's no such thing as natural speed for silent films.
And there's no such thing as constant speed for silent films in most cases.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, because the projectionists were very handy with the rheostats. But we're seeing just as compromised now. You know, you see a film with an alloy orchestra score. it's just the problem with film is it's always going to be filtered through the modern day sensibility. You know, Orson Welles said it's a dead thing. It's a dead canned thing. And a huge amount of what will make a picture work is what the audience brings to it. You know, and a lot of people will argue this, but it also the reason why, it's funny because we've both been talking about, you'll see a movie you didn't really like, but then you see it again later. And suddenly it's a different movie because you're in a different mood. You know, a lot of that's why I was never a successful critic, because you can't, everything is being filtered through your own perceptions. So, if you're on a lousy date, or you had a bad meal before, or you're tired, or it's the 8th film on a festival day, and you've been, and you can't even remember the other 7 things you've seen. You know, how can you really have a rational judgment on whatever it is you're going to see? And, and a lot of critics just, I was cranky, so the film sucked, There's way too much of that.
Well, that's why I don't read reviews from anybody anyway. So.
Well, critics are, critics are the most useless thing on the planet. Yeah. And the minute they're dead, they're completely, should be forgotten. I remember the point is made. Let's plug SlapstickCon. We gotta go to a showing, and we're not gonna be able to plug all this stuff. We're just, we can pontificate about
everything,
the nature of everything.
Everything will get plugged.
You know.
But I want to finish talking about your book first.
Okay. Which is coming out from Bear Manor Media. It'll be out in time, certainly for SlapstickCon. I'll be hawking it there, and it'll be on Amazon and stuff before that.
I want to have my copy by then. I'm looking forward to this. But tell us a little bit about who's in it, because there are several of these people that I'm only marginally familiar with.
Okay.
Such as Toto.
Right.
And I would think, looking through the book as quickly as I have, I saw a lot of people in there that I'm only kind of aware of. So give us a little bit about some people who you cover in this.
Kind of ties in to the whole Magnum concept of the three-volume trilogy. The comedy film industry, which it was. Again, we're talking about a whole generation of people, you know, as we were talking earlier, that really is one whole generation that created most of the great comedy. And unlike, you know, people with sort of surface interest in this, you know, comedy, the tip of the iceberg is Chaplin, Keaton, and Lloyd. I mean, there were literally hundreds of comedians. Same thing with Hal Roach. You know, tip of the iceberg is Harold Lloyd, Laurel and Hardy, you know, our gang. You know, for every successful series, he had other series that either were also reasonably successful or weren't successful or ran a few years and ran out. You know, there were a bunch of them. But they're all important to the Hal Roach style. Of course, the two main ones that we do discuss, at least when we started writing this stuff in the 90s, they were completely neglected. But actually, because I've been making noise about them and other people have, they're not as neglected now as they were. Charlie Chase and Max Davidson. Charlie Chase was probably the most important person in terms of the development of the Hal Roach style there ever was. You know, for starters, because he started out before even as a performer, a major comedy director. He spent, you know, 10 years in the industry as a comedy director. He was the first director general of the Hal Roach Studios, apart from Hal Roach, who also then brought most of the major creative people into the studio that created the style, trained Leo McCarey, because Leo McCarey, you know, started as out on his one-reelers, directing his one-reelers. You know, a huge influence, and all the way through his career as a star in his 16 years at Roach, was always the number two box office Roach star, which most people don't realize. They always think Our Gang would have been more, but no, his shorts, even all through the period, earned better than Our Gang.
Wow.
So, very important. And so, certainly we cover him. You know, Max Davidson, nowhere near that important just because it was a very short-lived series, but they're just such marvelous films. Yeah. And he's
great. Yeah, they're all funny.
Yeah, and he's great in them. But even with Charlie Chase, you suddenly, when you start studying the rest of Roach, realize Charlie, you know, I said the important thing about Charlie Chase was he was really kind of, you know, Harold Lloyd started the more normalizing of you know, just a normal looking person being a comedian, and then Chase, I always said, really brought it into 20s focus. With, I always said, you know, you had the emancipated woman in the 20s, but you also had the emancipated man, and that was Charlie Chase. You know, he embodied that. But you suddenly realize, if you go back a little farther, there's a comedian named Eddie Bolin. The Roach is basically trying to do what he does with Charlie Chase 3 years later. In fact, there's an Eddie Bolin short called, oh, I got my book there and I can't remember what it is. June Madness. No? I don't know. There's an Eddie Bolin short that Charlie Chase completely remakes as Dollar Dizzy. There's this whole gag sequence where there's all the, you know, Charlie Chase or Eddie Bolin is this rich guy and he's at this, you know, like country club, and all of these women are pretending to injure themselves to try to get his attention. And it's exactly the same gag sequence. You know, there's just all sorts of precedent. And all of these series that Roach tried, you know, somewhere contributes to that style that we all call the Hal Roach style now. And that's what we discuss all those. You know, we discuss people like I said, like Toto, which was a, Toto is one of the strangest comedians you will ever see.
Because I've only seen one of his films.
He was a hippodrome clown and one of the most incredible acrobats. And sadly, because so few of his films exist, you really don't see much of it. But I've got a Grantland Rice sports reel that has a chunk of his vaudeville act from 1929. and he's doing this mechanical toy thing. I've never seen anybody with, I mean, Buster Keaton didn't have it, Lupino Lane didn't have this kind of body control. He's he is in a flat on his back position, and he manages in very slow motion to completely head roll, and not only head roll, but stay in the head roll position in a very slow pivot, you know, doing a mechanical toy thing. It's like, it just makes my head hurt watching it. It's like, I don't know how you could learn that. I mean, the muscles you have to control to keep your body balancing on your head at a 45-degree angle and keep it there, not moving, is amazing. But he was an early one. And, we look in at things. You know, there were a lot of other, Glenn Tryon was a fascinating series at Roach because basically when Harold Lloyd left, Hal Roach said, screw it, I can create another Harold Lloyd. And he tried. And you know, he sticks Glenn Tryon in these two feature films, which were on the boards as Harold Lloyd films before Harold left. They were the 24 releases. And you just suddenly realize what Harold Lloyd brings to the mix. They're well-constructed films. They're entertaining. They're funny. They've got all the same cast people you see in the Lloyd films. And Tryon is completely invisible. Hmm. And he's not bad. He just, he's just not Harold Lloyd. And you realize Harold Lloyd should be there. Where is he? You know. So, and we talk about some of the, there were 30s series. We talk about the all-star comedies and the all the various female comedians they tried. He tried the Mabel Normand series, which I think is fascinating. A lot of the historians go, oh, it's poor, sad, drugged out Mabel. And those are five of the funniest films she ever made. Because however much she was Max Sennett's girlfriend and Keystone Mabel, she really didn't do that much in them except run around crazy and, get into her. You really, as a performer, I think she does way more in those things than she does even in all her various features that are just remakes of the Cinderella story.
Yeah. Yeah, every once in a while you see a Mabel Normand film and realize how good she should have always been.
Yeah, but didn't really have that many opportunities.
And it's really frustrating in some of those Sennett things to, she just kind of walks through them, and she really doesn't do much this way or that.
Yeah.
I'm real curious about the Roach style because I've never studied it myself as to how it evolved.
Right.
But I've always been aware of it in terms of at least what I think of the Roach style, which is very deliberate pacing, reciprocal violence, that sort of courtesy of violence.
Yeah.
I will stand here while you dump your soup on me, and then you must stand there while I do something back to you. That pretty much runs through the films, but mostly the pacing, I would say.
That's all part of it. Really what the Howard styles is even more subtle than that. What Howard really ended up doing was combining, when the comedy industry starts, we're talking literally, we're going back 1910 here and onward. Most of the comedies being made at that time were actually, polite sort of social comedies, middle class characters, that kind of thing. That's why I always love to hear somebody call Max Sennett comedies crude, and I said they're not. Because what they are is really a reaction against what was being done at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And their crudity and vulgarity is extremely calculated, and very well planned. And they said Sennett was sort of a backlash against, what I kind of call the Vitagraph style, because they were the ones that really distilled it. But then Al Christie, who's another major comedy producer that almost nobody talks about anymore, although really he was as successful as Senator Roach at the time. At the time, they were all perceived as, sure, as top comedy producers. He really carried on that polite situation comedy style, no grotesques, good-looking young middle-class people getting into just kind of comic situations. And really what Roach manages to do, or actually, I have to say the Roach Studio, because the other sad thing, and I talk about in the introduction of the book, is Roach's main gift to comedy production was the fact that he was basically a businessman who just hired the best people, put them in a nice studio situation, gave them a good thing, and left them alone. And if you don't think that's brilliant, try to think how many other producers you've ever heard who were smart enough to do that. But he really was not a hands-on, day-to-day, really work, you know, and certainly not the way Max Sennett was, who would drive his staffs crazy and really oversaw everything. And Al Christie, who directed probably more of his films than any of the other producers did. But what the Roach style ended up distilling was the concept of, yeah, let's get away from the funny mustaches, let's get away from the clown white, let's make our people more human, but let's keep the slapstick, let's keep the gag situations. There's another way of doing this. And you know, because again, the early Roach stuff, you know, the Harold Lloyd's, you know, even in the teens, you look at the Lonesome Lukes and the early Roach stuff, he's just imitating Sennett. And then Lloyd kind of figures out, you know, let's get a little more normal. You know, just get the glasses character, be a nice young man. There's still, because you still got Snub Pollard with the Kaiser Wilhelm mustache. There's still some aspects of that. And the Lloyd one-reelers are very slapsticky. But it's heading in that direction. Then, you know, Lloyd goes very much in that direction from the two-reelers on. And so Roach figures this out. And then, like I said, he's got Snub Pollard. He's got Paul Parrott. He's got some more Sennett-type comedians. But immediately we're heading more toward the Charlie Chase, you know, the R Gang kids, which are just basically normal, you know, normal kids, doing reasonably normal kid things. And, you know, they come to that. And then it all really comes together with Charlie Chase, who again starts his background as a Sennett writer director, you know, works with, you know, all pretty much almost every major comedian you can name in the teens. I mean, he's worked with Chaplin. I don't think he ever worked with Keaton, certainly, but almost anybody else you can name, he worked with as a director, as a comedy craftsman. And I think he comes to the studio, and this is exactly what he wants to do. And the Chase comedies really set the pace for that style. And then Laurel and Hardy come along and just, you know, add the icing to the cake. But again, with Stan Laurel, a lot of that influence, Harry Langdon always said was the most influential of the comedians in terms of all the other comedians, because basically after Langdon comes on the scene in 24, 25, you can see his influences in every single one of the other comedians, including Chaplin. Because he's the one who says, slow the pace down to a crawl. And you know, he's the one that does that. And Laurel, I mean, all you got to do is look at Laurel pre-1924 and Laurel post-19, you know, 25, 26 to see the influence. But yeah, Laurel and Hardy just bring it all down. Still have a lot of the old comedy slapstick concepts, but also, in, you know, are a little more normal, middle class. You know, I mean, their characters can be married to people and try to hold down jobs and, you know, and that kind of thing. Far more logic, even comedy logic, comes into it in the Roach Studios in the late 20s. And that's its flowering, yeah. You know. And it carries over into talkies and then falls apart as short comedies become too expensive to make. And, you know.
Yeah, the Roach films are, in the aggregate, my favorite live-action comedy shorts.
Yeah.
Because I always tend to think of the Laurel and Hardy and the R Gangs as being similar in tone, mm-hmm. but they're really not, except just in terms of overall pacing and so forth. But mm-hmm. as you say, Laurel and Hardy, to me, have always been slightly more surreal. They're normal guys, mm-hmm. but especially Stan is a little bit otherworldly.
Always, yeah. Always,
but the gang are simply kids doing.
Well, you have the surreal nature. I mean, how many dyslexically painted fire trucks did we ever build in our childhood?
These were very ambitious.
Goat and dog powered, yes. You know.
Well, since we are winding down in our time, I want you to tell me a little bit about SlapstickCon coming up, but also I want you to tell me a little bit about how SlapstickCon came about. It's not that old a
It's almost festival, 10 years. Actually, it's 10 years old. This is our 10th year. We haven't
to me,
managed
that's a
to
very
do a show every year, but yeah, we had a couple of breaks. Basically, it came about because there were a number of comedy fans who were tired of not enough comedies being shown at the other festivals. And in 2003, our founding father, we give him this credit, Rob Farr, because it was indeed him who realized, hey, I work for Arlington County in Virginia, and they have this theater, the Spectrum Theater, which I can get my hands on for the weekend, and we got a barn? I got people with lots of films. Let's put on a show. And so we put on the first one there in 2003 and got a decent turnout. 150 people showed up. So, you know, did it again, and it started growing. And we were very lucky again when you're in Arlington, which is basically Washington, D.C., we had the support of some nice institutions like the Library of Congress and UCLA Film and Television Archive and a lot of the archives. It just snowballed, and basically after the first one, I've been stuck with putting them on every year. But Rob Farr is still our founding father.
Now, the first ones, because you had that theater and everything, they were mostly 35 prints?
The first one was all 16mm, except we did a 35mm show at the National Gallery, which was an incredible show. Unfortunately, it was free admission. But we had 500 people show up to watch, you know, Fox Sunshine comedies.
Wow.
And they loved them. And it was great. We installed 30, it was funny, at Spectrum Theater, we literally had to build the booth, and there was no booths. I mean, the booth was there, but there was no projection equipment. So we built our booth completely from up and down when we do the shows. So we put in 35mm equipment in 2005, and then we had 35 there after that. So that's when we quit doing National Gallery shows, which were great, but were not making us a dime. So it was kind of like, yeah, you know, whatever. But attendance, you know, grew every year, and, you know, the theater seated 300 and some, and we were, by the last one we did there in 2010, we were pretty close to packing the theater. We never sold out, but we came darn close a couple times. And about half, and it was always about 50-50 out-of-towners and regulars and general public there. And that's what I always thought was really heartening.
That is nice, yeah.
Including a number of young folk. So we thought we were introducing people. This year, we have now parted company with Arlington County. And our new home is at the University Cinema at Indiana University in Bloomington, which is a beautiful theater. With its own booth. I mean, it's a beautiful state-of-the-art archival projection, 1635 video. And it's a gorgeous old theater on a beautiful campus. And so far, I'm really getting, you know, even jaded, cranky old me again, really excited about the fact that we're doing it there.
Now, you obviously, you show exclusively comedies there. What's your outside date? What's the last date that you will show a comedy?
Our ranges are pretty... Actually, in 2010, we showed a drama. We showed The Roundup with Roscoe Arbuckle.
Okay, I can see it. I can see it.
So we can be kind of contrary once in a while. But it tied in. We tend to stay silent era, or, you know, the comedy film industry, 1910 to 1945. But we veer beyond that. We've done Ernie Kovacs tributes. We've run, you know, we ran a Danny Kaye picture one year. If there's something that just hasn't been seen or needs attention paid to, we're doing a Marx Brothers rarity show this year, which is going to be a lot of 50s television. Stuff, 50s and 60s, even little 70s is going to creep into that. So, we've covered Buster Keaton's entire career. I mean, we were getting pretty good at unveiling an industrial film every year that nobody had ever seen or heard of or knew existed. We did a lot early on. That's another thing that's always kind of driven me crazy about, you know, preconceived notions. You know, Buster Keaton's career ended when talkies came in and he was a drunk. And it's like, no.
He was just getting started.
Yeah, the most amazing. Buster Keaton had the most amazing career of anybody in show business. Sure. You know, this is a guy who worked with Lillian Russell and Annette Funicello. You know, I mean, you just, there aren't those kind, I mean, yeah. and worked, you know, he has a 60 plus year career, you know, I mean, and you know, the people who love to perceive him as the sad, broken down old man, it's like Buster made more money in the last 15 years of his life he ever made working for Joe Skank.
Sure.
You know, I said I first knew him as a television personality.
Me too, yeah. Candid Camera is where I first
knew
him.
Yeah, and a lot of that work is good. I mean, even, you know, people like to look down at those Beach Blanket Bingo pictures. It's called, no, these aren't poor, sad beef. This is, for starters, they're some of the top box office films of 1965.
Sure.
And here's Buster keep putting his face in front of an audience, you know, in front of a young, you know, audience. I always love all those AIP things. They always knew. You know, you get Frank and Annette, but then you'd put Basil Rathbone and Dorothy L'Amour. You had all these old pros making the picture work while you know, mm-hmm. you know, try to see that now into, you know, today's sure. teen, you know, movies.
Yeah.
So, that, you know, all of the work is fascinating. And to me, it's just amazing that he continued to reinvent himself in any number of ways to just continue working.
Yeah. And in fact, his down period is a relatively brief.
Yes, it is.
I've had much more of a down period than Buster Keaton ever had. Much more.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I don't even drink.
Yeah, I mean, even it is at the height of his drinking problems and stuff in the 30s, I mean, he's still all those educational comedies, you look at those things and you realize he's probably shaking off some nasty hangovers and he's still going out there and doing incredible work.
Well, what do you got lined up for this year?
Oh,
I wish I could go.
Well, let's give the dates first. It's June 27th through the 30th.
Okay.
Last weekend in June. And you can go to www.slapstickon.org to get all the information. It'll send you to the Indiana University website to buy tickets.
And everybody will be able to remember that date because June 30th is my wife's birthday.
There you go.
And so everybody listening to this clearly knows.
Well, I think that will be a wonderful birthday present.
It would be
for
a
her.
Wonderful birthday present
should,
for her.
Should,
yes,
should take her. Well, the big things. What are we doing? What are we running? Well, we have some great new restorations. Here's a comedy name everyone will know: Monty Banks.
I know him.
You know him. we're running a brand new LOC restoration of Attaboy, 1926 feature that he did. That is loads of fun. LLC's also restoring, as we speak, which is making me nervous, but it should be done in time, a Walter Ford, British kind of feature. Now, Walter Ford, do you know Walter Ford?
Sure.
Good for you. Good for you. Reasonably major British comedian in the 20s, darn good British director in the 30s. Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've ever seen him as a performer. I've only seen his films as a director.
We're showing his... No, it's not his last. I think he made, well, it's his last completely silent feature, and then he made one that was a part talkie. But it's called "Would You Believe It," which is hilarious, and has some interesting. It's the only comedy I've ever seen that spoofs Fritz Lang's Spies. I'll say that. It's a fun film. That's one of our restorations. We're going to be having some interesting guests. We're bringing over a British collector, film collector named David Wyatt. Who's also bringing a lot of neat film goodies with him. We tend to show four or five features and a lot of shorts. We put together, you know, there's a Hal Roach collection of shorts, you know, program. We'll be running, you know, all sorts of different, some interesting Hal Roach things like, Somewhere and Somewhere, which stars Charlie Murray, a Senate comedian working in a Hal Roach all-star. You'll see Snub Pollard in All in a Day, a rare Harold Lloyd called Follow the Crowd.
What year is that? I don't even
Fall of Crowd, 1918. So one really very weird one. Very black. He's fighting a black hand gang in that, and it gets very odd. We'll be doing a Senate set with again some very rare Senate Paramounts that are being restored by LSE. Gee Whiz and She Loved Him Plenty, 1918, 1919. Very few Senate Paramounts exist, and it's very nice that we've got a couple of new ones.
Yeah.
We run the gamut. We'll have we were talking about the Weiss brothers earlier, and I'm going to put in a plug for my DVD Weissorama, from VCI. We like to represent, because so many Weiss brother comedies exist in absolutely pristine, gorgeous material that you just don't see that many comedies that look that way. So we always have a segment we call Weissaroni, which is what I really originally wanted to call Weissorama, where we'll be seeing, comedians like Ben Turpin, who worked for the Weisses, Snub Pollard, the ever lovable Jimmy Aubrey.
Mm-hmm.
we'll be seeing another neat show, another feature we're going to run. And this is rare because you're not even going to see it come out on video because there's rights issues involved. We're going to run the 1946 monogram feature, Bringing Up Father.
Oh.
The first Jigs and Maggie.
I've never seen that. Always wanted to see that.
Which, contrary to, perceived wisdom of those who haven't seen it but make judgments. You always hear, oh, poor, it written directed by Eddie Klein. Mm-hmm. Oh, poor old beaten down Eddie Klein was working in Monogram, blah, 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 blah. This thing, basically Eddie Klein just take, Monogram's bought the rights to Harriman? George Harriman?
Yeah.
And he appears in the thing too, by the way.
Really?
And Klein just lovingly recreates it with as many good comedians as Monogram can afford, including a part that was very obviously written for Buster Keaton, but they obviously couldn't afford him. So you got people like, Tim Ryan, Tom Kennedy, Jimmy Aubrey again in one of the biggest, talking picture parts, and Mickey Rooney's dad, Joel Yule Sr., who is as funny as Mickey and not as annoying. And playing a really, really great Jigs.
That's
and
win-win.
Yeah. And Randy Riano was like born to play Maggie. I mean, who else? It was like Gail Henry should always have played Olive Oil. It's hilarious. It is beautifully, it's a beautiful, loving tribute to Jigs and Maggie. I've seen all those Jigs. Actually, they're all not bad, but the first one is really good. And it's a Bringing Up Father show because we're also going to run one of the 1920 International Film Service Jigs and Maggies with Johnny Ray and a very young Laura LaPlante playing the daughter, which is also very bizarre and fun. So these are the kind of things that make me excited, but these are all really good.
I'm excited good things. Too and profoundly depressed that I can't be there.
Try to
get some wealthy relative.
Write a comedy book. We'll make you a guest one of these years, But apart from all of these names that nobody's ever heard, hey, we're showing a smiling Billy Mason, a mishap of Musty Suffer, which are almost blacker than Ham and Bud. We're also showing one of those.
Wow. I've never heard of any of those except Ham and Bud.
Yeah. Fatty Voss, Carter DeHaven. Mr. and Mrs. What else? We've got a Victor Moore, clever comedy from 1917, Faint Heart and Fair Lady. Very, very good film. But we're also showing Buster, there'll be some Buster Keaton, some Harry Langdon, but not the ones you're used to seeing.
Sure.
We run the people you've heard of. The one trick is when we're introducing you to obscure people, rest assured somebody has actually seen these films. So they're going to be. There's a reason we're showing.
In some way, yeah.
Right, they're going to be. They have something to sell, apart from obscurity. So
okay, well, I'll have the website for Slapstickon on my website.
Great.
So all listeners here, both of you, and tell both of your friends to go to thecommentarytrack.com. Then you'll see the Slapstickon website from there. And
some of my DVDs too, maybe.
We'll plug all of your DVDs that are for sale. They'll all have Amazon links.
And if we're lucky, Bear Manor will have the book up.
Wouldn't that be sweet?
To plug by that time.
Believe me, I'm only saying this. I've only looked at this book for minutes on the computer here, but I want it. It's got, just looking at the pictures, I want it.
He was so, drooling on the keyboard,
yes,
folks.
I drooled all over the, it shorted out. It's, I'm not going to be able to play Word Womp for another week. So, believe me, we'll have all that stuff on. And we should all get down to UCLA now and watch some comedy.
Yeah, we got other things to do.
Yeah, we
got
more important things to do than this.
But thanks for listening, folks.
I do appreciate your listening. And, Richard, thanks so much for coming by and doing this.
My pleasure. Thanks for lunch.
I've been looking forward to this for a long time. And,
wow, well, that's great.
So I'm glad we finally got a chance to sit and talk.
Yeah, absolutely.
So good. Thanks, Richard Roberts. And we will see you next time.
Goodbye now.
I sure hope you enjoyed my conversation with Richard Roberts. We left here, hopped in our cars, and headed down to UCLA to see some Laurel and Hardy shorts because it is now time for the UCLA Festival of Preservation. They only do it every other year now, which makes me sad because I love it, and it was always a wonderful experience, and it still is. It's just every other year instead of every year. But here it is, and if you live in the Los Angeles area, or if you're going to be here in the next month or so, get out here, because there's some wonderful stuff coming up. In fact, I just found out that at the screening of this coming weekend's International House, the great comedy with W.C. Fields and Burns and Allen and so forth, the Rose Marie will be there to do a Q&A, and Scott McQueen, who is the brilliant head of preservation at UCLA now, will be interviewing her, and so that's going to be a real treat, because she was a real cutie in that film, and I think a lot of people who only know her from the Dick Van Dyke Show aren't really aware of her previous life as a child singing star, and when you see her, it's really something. So if you're in the area, come to see that, and look online for the schedule for the UCLA Festival of Preservation, because there's lots of really great stuff coming up, and I'm very excited about a whole bunch of it. So, let's thank all the people who helped get the podcast up and running, and I want to apologize for my wheezing voice this week. I'm quite sick. And now don't start backing away from your iPods. You can't catch it online. But, man, I feel awful. So, that's why I'm being so brief and yet so breathy. I feel like I'm going, so you're just going to have to get used to that. I'm not on my deathbed or anything, just a sick guy, just an Alka-Seltzer PM sort of mood. So, I want to thank everybody who's helped me put this on despite my illness, my wonderful and glorious wife, Claire McCullough, who is my announcer, James Hutchins, who designed my website, thecommentarytrack.com, and also my personal website, frankthompson.tv. I always like to thank Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for contributing the wonderful music that starts and closes every single one of these podcasts, at least so far. You never can tell what's around the corner, can you? Maybe some surprises. But I love their music, and I'm proud to have it attached to the show. So, Richard Roberts, my guest, has had his hand in a lot of things, as we heard in his interview, and there will be DVDs linked to Amazon on the website. So please, if you feel like buying something, go to thecommentarytrack.com and order all of Richard's DVDs, Slap Happy and Lysorama and all the others, and click through my site, and I'll get a little bit of a kickback. And Richard will sell DVDs, and you'll have DVDs, and Amazon will sell DVDs. And doesn't that make a circle of goodness? Isn't that a wonderful thing where everybody wins out? And I mean everybody. This is a great thing. So please do that. I'm going to go back to bed and start groaning again and stop my wheezing into the microphone. So I want to thank you for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next week when I have another great guest. In the meantime, don't you worry, we'll fix it in post.